you know, the toothpick at the end of the raving tool. So, the problem still persists, and it will continue. The testing will continue until someday soon. Hopefully, I'll get to the bottom of it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the best piece of instrumentation I can think of to do what you're doing, Joe, would be a fairly high resolution spectrum analyzer. If you had a spectrum analyzer that had the ability to lock onto the crystal, in other words, you got the synthesizer running, and let me pick a number. Let's assume that your synthesizer puts out 800 megacycles, and you set the spectrum analyzer in the phase lock loop mode of its first oscillator, and now you're using the narrow sweep characteristic of the spectrum analyzer. And if you're lucky enough to get your hands on a spectrum analyzer that has a res bandwidth of 10 hertz, some of the really good spectrum analyzers will be down to a resolution bandwidth of 10 hertz. So with 10 hertz of resolution, and in close where the whole down display across the screen is only going to be 100 hertz or 500 hertz wide, you're going to go into the 50 hertz per centimeter display mode if your spectrum analyzer can do that. With 10 hertz of resolution, it's going to be a very slow, sweeping signal on that screen. But once you've got that, because you know that your engraving tool is making a 60-cycle component and harmonics of the 60 cycles, with that spectrum analyzer set up that way, you will find that 60 hertz away from the carrier, you're going to see a bump in the display. At 120 hertz, at 180 hertz, you're going to see bumps in the display. And now, a good board is going to have small bumps, and a bad board is going to have bigger bumps, which really is the amount of spectral purity we're talking about. The other approach I can think of is to take the oscillator output into a good receiver, a really good receiver, like another handy-talkie, where it is looking at the carrier frequency. If you can adjust the carrier frequency of the synthesizer to be one of the frequencies that the other receiver listens to, and some of your receivers with modern-day circuitry are using, I think it's 12.5 kc of channel spacing, that implies that the actual IF strip in that receiver is in the vicinity of 5 kilohertz wide. And yes, the way the audio circuit works on those receivers, they're probably only passing audio frequencies from 500 hertz to 2.5 kc. If you could tap into the audio of that receiver, where before that high-pass filter, you could really see the 60 hertz, the 120 hertz, and 180 hertz amplitude of the signal the receiver is seeing when it looks at the output of that synthesizer. That's another good way in which you could now measure amplitude difference between a good board and a bad board. I wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. And with the stuff that you have at your disposal, do you think you can come close to doing either one of those tests? The V2RYY, as I said, you're into a high-tech area. K2RIW in the tech minute.
Well, the bad news is, you know, they don't seem to have an analyzer that I've seen that goes below 2 kilohertz per division. So looking at something in narrow bandwidth type of capacity, you can sort of throw that out the window.
Okay, the next step is, are you able to tune the synthesizer to a frequency where another known receiver can tune to it and listen to it? And it's an FM receiver that has a 12.5 kc of channel spacing. You get to the center of one of those 12.5 kc channels and now really listen to that signal with high gain audio coming out of that second receiver. You're going to hear that vibration, whether you knock on it with a pencil and you're making real shocks, or whether you knock on it with your engraving tool. So is there a possibility that you can tune the synthesizer to a frequency where some other known good receiver in the shop can tune to that frequency, FM receiver? Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
That's a difficult one because the IF of this radio is 70.05 megahertz, and it's high side injection. So if I'm listening to a frequency approximately 873, it's putting on a carrier, 70.05 higher than that. And I don't know if I have any equipment receiver-wise that's capable of receiving in that part of the band. That's going to be a problem.
Hey, Joe, I got a solution for you. In the case of an FM radio, where you're listening to an FM signal, the IF strip and the FM demodulator doesn't give a damn who did the FM. If the signal coming into the front end of the receiver is a known good frequency synthesized signal generator or a crystal oscillator, and now you're not FMing the signal, you're FMing the LO. If that synthesizer board is the LO, and therefore it is squittering around while the radio is tuned to a known, clean, pure, better than 20 dB quieting signal, which where there's no residual amplitude or FM modulation on the signal, a good signal generator, a good crystal control source coming in, and now this is the local oscillator for that radio, as I said, you're going to get that response out of the discriminator. It doesn't matter if you move the if the signal is FMing or the LO is FMing. Either one is going to create the FM in the IF strip, and the discriminator will respond to it. You see what I'm saying, Joe? So V2RYY, you can do it backwards. T2RYW in the tech net.
Yeah, I follow you. I'd have to set up some other instrumentation to be able to look at the thing in a little more detail to be able to look at that. And I know what you're saying. The synthesizer of the bad part is going to have a little different spectral purity at close in. And using a receiver that has a fairly narrow bandwidth, you'd be able to detect that differential between a good one and a bad one if you listen to something possibly the on channel or slightly off channel, correct?
You got it, Joe. Don't have to tune on channel, off channel. You're going to be putting a signal from a known good signal generator, a crystal oscillator, a good synthesized signal generator, whatever. In the center of channel, a strong signal is going to be coming into the front end of the radio. The local oscillator is going to be your suspicious synthesizer. And if your suspicious synthesizer is creating any kind of undesired FM modulation, and that is the mode of failure you're talking about, and now you're listening to the output of that radio with the audio turned up nice and loud, and now that suspicious printed circuit board, you're tapping on it with a screwdriver, you're hitting it with your engraving tool, and now you're going to hear that FM it's creating. So whether you move the signal or whether you move the LO, doesn't matter. The discriminator is going to respond the same way, and the signal is going to be right in the center of channel. You're not trying to tune off to one side and let the radio listen to the sideband. Now, that's too difficult. Right on channel, on center, it's going to do it, Joe. And the only thing I'm worried about is that the normal audio passband of that radio, doesn't pass anything below 300 hertz. And when you're tapping on it, you're going to be getting signals above 300 hertz, no problem. But if you want to hear it with your engraving tool, which is 60 hertz, 120 hertz, and 180 hertz components, then you might have to tap into the audio before it has its high pass filter. And maybe not. Even with its high pass filter, where it doesn't pass signals below 300 hertz, it is passing signals below 300 hertz. They're just 10 dB down, if you know what I mean. So carefully listening, it's going to be there, Joe. You might have to use earphones, but you're going to hear it. And then you're going to hear a difference in that amplitude between a known good board and a bad board. So now you're testing it under real working conditions. It's the real synthesizer for a real radio. That's as much as an in-situ measurement as you can make. In other words, you're putting it into the real environment. Over to you, Joe. K2LIW.
Repeater. Time out.
We'll be continuing when I get back to working on these again. So, okay, you come up with some very good suggestions, and I'll see if I can implement one or two of them or not in here and go forward and see which direction it brings me in. Thank you very much, Dick. Okay, W2RYW, W2RYY.
Hey, John, sounds like we've got another almost happy customer for the time being. We'll have to send him a bill. That's a joke between us. Hey, John, what kind of fancy emails have you been getting this week? KC2WGB. How big is the mailbag this week? K2LIW in the TechNet.
unfortunately, I won't be able to participate tonight because I haven't had a chance to go through the mailbag. I just returned from the hospital 45 minutes ago, so I just came down here to participate in it as best I can. But we'll pick it up next week with that. But and this is for something different, not the same visitation I had last time. Still be something. But back to you, Dick.
Gee, Joe, John, I hope everything's all right. You sound awful good. Take your own sweet time and read some of those letters. Paul's going to be keeping us busy for quite a while, and you may be able to find a letter where you're listening with one ear on what Paul is saying, because you don't want to miss that, and your eyes are going to be scanning some of these letters you've gotten. So maybe you're going to find one in the next few minutes, in the next half hour or so. So, Paul, WS2N, I hope you're... Did you recover from all of that sunshine that you got today when you were out at the flea market? WS2N, K2LIW, and the Tech Man?
Before Paul, I wonder how do you feel, John, and is everything okay? And to see him.
Thank you for asking. Yes, Wes, I'm fine. My own stupidity. I went into insulin shock, but I'll discuss that later. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. That strikes me as a little bit on the serious side. Paul, if you made a transmission, it was quite weak. Maybe you're trying to come through the eastern input, or maybe your antenna's not aimed at this one yet. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I turned my antenna. Plus, I was portable before, so I copied it.
Beautiful copy, Paul. Please proceed. And what's the latest on Kepler? Maybe they don't know yet. I sure hope they can get Kepler operating again. There was a nice article about Kepler in the newspaper that's printed on Long Island out in the Hamptons. Can't think of the name of the paper right now. There's a nice article this week about Kepler there, although there's a couple of errors in the article. I'll discuss those a little bit later. So, what's NASA doing this week, Paul? WS2N, you sound good. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Like John, I was busy, but not with anything serious like that. Well, I'm not sure what... It sounded like he was either visiting somebody or he was there. Bus together. I don't know, John. If you're in, you sounded good, like you said. So I'm not sure what the problem was, but hope it worked itself out. First of all, I was on the HT before. Yeah, trying to make Selden with that, with the Smiley 5.8 whip. And that wasn't going to make it. I mean, I could make it, but not good enough. So now I'm back on the base rig. Couple things. Well, Kepler, I don't have any further updates on that. But the Russians launched another Soyuz rocket to the space station last week. Brought up three people, one Russian, one European Space Agency astronaut, and a female, Kathy Nyberg, I think, been up before, and then that's the American astronaut. Let me drop it. Staying on the space station till middle of November, so it's like a six-month run. These visits to the space station are getting longer and longer. I believe next year they're going to send an American up for a solid year, maybe the year after. I forgot the schedule. The brother of the of Gabby Giffords, the one that was shot, the congresswoman in Arizona, you know, Scott is an astronaut, and his brother, twin brother Kelly, Mark Kelly is going to spend a year on the International Space Station, and they'll have a couple of those after that, and they want to really test out long duration space flight. I mean, the Russians have done it. They've had one guy, he's gone like a year and a half. But they want to do this on a regular basis now. Let me drop it. WS2N. So that's one thing. And then, interesting, I'm listening to CBS News, and they did a report on the Voyager spacecraft. And, you know, things that we talked about here on the net. I mean, it's been 35 years. They're both still working, functioning. And they talked about, you know, I know that they have, you know, back in 1977, they ran a lot of equipment on digital tapes. Well, they have a digital tape recorder, which was advanced for that time. They, you know, it wasn't analog, it was digital. To do all the recordings, they, you know, get up, you know, store up all these thousands of bits of pictures and data, and they would send it back. But the way it was stored was actually on a digital audio tape, a DAT tape. And now it turns out that that thing, that tape, is actually nothing but an 8-track tape. So here we're depending on information from, well, I believe the Voyager 1 has already broken through the heliosphere, but they say maybe, maybe not. I think it's through from what I read as of last August. Here these things were depending on the information, because every time the antenna is not pointing towards or transmitting or whatever, it's storing information. And when it's pointing to us, then it'll transmit the data. We're depending on 8-track tapes coming from the out of solar system. Back to you for now, Dick, and we'll continue on. WS2.
Yeah, very fine, Paul. To repeat what John said, John just came out of the hospital where he did say he had an insulin shock where there was an error, and my guess is there was an error in the medications that he was giving himself, and that created an insulin shock and sent him to the hospital for a short period of time. He's going to be giving us a little more detail on that. In the case of 8-track tape, the early recordings for the Voyager spacecraft, that was the technology of those days. I mean, what kind of magnetic tapes you use, what kind of video cassette recorder tapes you use, it continuously changes. Now we're using these much higher density discs. Whatever medium you store your photographs and your audio on, whether it be slides, film, VCR tape, or whatever, the medium is continuously changing. Our computers can no longer handle some of the older formats. We have to continuously be converting to the newer formats. It's a pain. But when it comes to miles per watt, that Voyager, one of the questions we were asked 2 weeks ago by an amateur, let me drop. Which frequencies work the best for long range? And by far, the higher frequency, the better, when it's in free space. The 8.5 gigahertz signal being downlinked from the Voyager spacecraft is in the vicinity of 10 watts of RF. And that spacecraft is in the vicinity of 11 billion miles away. I think it's something like 110 astronomical units. Approximately 3 times the distance to Pluto is where the Voyager is right now. So around 11 billion miles, around 10 watts of audio, we're getting a billion miles per watt of QRP or of DX out of that spacecraft. Nothing, to my knowledge, has come close to that kind of miles per watt. So most of us would consider a 10-watt transmitter, ham radio-wise, to talk across a couple of states or to talk to Canada or to try to, on some frequency, talk to Europe. We consider it, you know, fishing with light line, pretty far DX. And here they are in the vicinity of 11 billion miles away. The signal takes something like 11 hours one way to get there. Something like a 25 or 30 hours round trip. It's a long distance at the speed of light. And when you look at the website for NASA on Voyager, let me drop. You'll see that in the last fraction of a year, the amount of cosmic ray particles it's seeing is suddenly climbing very high. It suddenly took an upslope in the number of cosmic rays versus the date horizontal display versus a vertical display, an XY display. And the explanation for that is that it's leaving the heliosphere, it's leaving the area of the magnetic field of this solar system and this sun. It's now looking at the galactic magnetic field. Therefore, the direction of arrival of the cosmic rays is changing, the magnitude, the number of them is changing. The magnetic field around the Earth is a beautiful shield where many of the particles coming out of the sun or coming from space get deflected by that magnetic field and don't hit the Earth. Well, what I think they're slowly discovering, what they're really discovering, is that the cosmic rays from space, when they come into our solar system, get deflected by the magnetic field coming from our sun. And now that Voyager is getting beyond that magnetic field, it's starting to see a sudden rise in those cosmic rays. So that's one possible explanation as to what's going on. Another thing that excites the daylights out of me, let me drop, is that when you go to the right website for NASA on the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, this very strong magnetic field sensing device, this multi-ton thing that was installed on the International Space Station a year or two ago, which is very carefully analyzing the extremely high-power cosmic rays from space. And they've analyzed, I forget the number, but something like 400,000 events have been analyzed. Of those events, I forget the number now that are positrons. Yes. Of the electron-like devices they've seen, some crazy percentage, like 40% of them, are positrons. In other words, antimatter coming from space is a high percentage of what they're seeing when you have the right kind of a detector up above the atmosphere, and it has the right kind of detecting characteristics that it can tell one from the other. So we've always been talking about the fact that all our measurements in this particular solar system and galaxy tell us that we see nothing but matter. In our experimental laboratories, you can make a tiny bit of antimatter. Once in a blue moon, on a detector on the surface of the Earth, you see evidence of antimatter. You put the right kind of a high-power detector in space, and 40% of the electrons you see are antimatter. That's significant. That's telling me, let me drop.
Dick, could you repeat that?
Yeah. When you go to the website of the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, this high-power cosmic ray detector that was installed on the International Space Station a year or two ago by the last flight of the Enterprise, the space shuttle, installed this thing. It's a very heavy object, huge magnetic field inside of it. When you look at the events that it has recorded to date, when it comes to the electron events, the high-power electrons as cosmic rays, something like 40% of them are positrons, antimatter. What that's telling me is that this particular solar system, this particular galaxy, is made out of matter. A hell of a lot of those cosmic rays are coming from outside of this solar system or outside of this galaxy, and 40% of them are antimatter. That's giving me a hint. I can tell by the way the astronaut, by the way the scientists that give you an interpretation of what they're seeing. Let me drop. They're taking a very careful, early interpretation, saying we're not quite sure what this means yet. We're going to wait until we gather a little bit more data. But I'm hearing the leading edge of what I think is the fact that outside of our galaxy or outside of our solar system, I'm not sure which, there's a hell of a lot of antimatter. I'm guessing that the antimatter has always been there. We just haven't been detecting it. Because by the time antimatter comes into our detectors on planet Earth, it has to go through a hell of a lot of air molecules, so to speak, and ionosphere and everything else of positive matter. and as such, it gets immediately annihilated, and we don't see the antimatter. You put the right kind of a detector in space above our atmosphere, outside of some of our magnetic field, where it's starting to see the real stuff out there, and something like 40% of the electron-type cosmic rays happen to be antimatter. That's telling me that up till now we've been really perplexed by the fact that everything we know about the Big Bang says that the Big Bang should have resulted in the equal amount of matter and antimatter, and how come we see nothing but matter? We don't see antimatter. We're suddenly discovering the antimatter is there. It's just not in our particular solar system, or it's not in our particular galaxy. The next galaxy over from us that's making a whole bunch of cosmic rays by all of those stars that are exploding, and all of those neutron stars being created, whatever, they happen to be antimatter. And now when you look at the real stuff with this alpha magnetic spectrometer, you're starting to see the real antimatter that has always been there. I am guessing, let me drop. I'm guessing that when we finally make the right kind of measurements, we're going to discuss that the original concept that after the Big Bang, half of all the universe was matter and half of it was antimatter is turning out to be true. Just our particular solar system or our particular galaxy happens to be matter. The adjacent one over there, maybe it's the one that's got antimatter in it. You see what I think is going on there, John? KC2WGB, if that's true, exciting stuff. K2LAW in the second half.
Thank you for the second explanation, Dick. But isn't it possible that the antimatter exists in our universe by itself? Maybe it wasn't all eliminated. It doesn't necessarily have to be coming from outside. It could be our exploding stars that are causing it. Nope. Back to you, Dick.
Well, you made the next jump, John, into another universe. I'm saying that this solar system and maybe this particular galaxy that we're part of, the so-called Milky Way galaxy, I am guessing that it is a positive matter galaxy and a positive matter solar system. I am guessing the next galaxy over could be antimatter. And by the way, when you're looking at the emission of a star, when you're looking at the Doppler shift and the red shift and whatever, whether or not the original radio wave or the original infrared, ultraviolet, whatever you're looking at, the fact that it came from a matter or antimatter, you can't tell the difference. You don't get negative frequency, if you know what I mean. So once we put the right kind of a detector in space where it's not seeing contaminated results, you take an antimatter cosmic ray particle, a positron, and you let it impact the Earth's atmosphere, it's going to get annihilated because it's going to be seeing positive matter under theory. But you put it above our atmosphere, and you're starting to see the antimatter that has always been there. So is it another universe? Maybe. It doesn't have to be another universe. I think just another galaxy. For all I know, one galaxy away or five galaxies away from us is an antimatter galaxy. I don't think it has to be another universe. Although, as you know, I've also got a theory that there's a whole bunch of multiverses out there that just happen to be beyond our visual ranging capability of the current equipment we're using. KC2WGB. Bunch of guesses on my part, John. Be careful. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Question enthusiast.
Okay, Dick. Well, that lets me believe also that our own galaxy could be producing them. Maybe it's not coming from outside our galaxy, but go ahead, pick up Wes.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, you got it, Wes. Thank you, XJN. Take your IW and pick that.
In regards to the MS-02 experiment of NASA, when we were talking about dimension, possible dimension, you start to talk about antimatter. Well, the positron is the anti-electro or say anti-particle or antimatter with a spin of half and a mass the same one. But my question then is, just because it does have a different charge, does that qualify the antimatter to an another dimension, let me go. Your situation when the low energy positron collides with the low energy electron, there is a certain inhalation that occurs resulting the production of two or more gamma ray photons. The gamma ray photons don't belong to either one, but they belong to the reality of fact of measurement, so that would be our dimension. So yes, there is an electropositron inhalation, but in particle physics, the antimatter is the material that is composed of antiparticles, which have the same mass as the ordinary matter, but the opposite charge of the quantum spin. My question is, to make it straight, how do you understand the relation of the quantum spin in antimatter and the difference in the comparing to the matter? And to Israel.
There's a couple of pieces of information I didn't give you guys. As I said, when you go to the NASA site on the subject of the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, AMS system, huge magnet with a very fancy detector. This is a couple of tons of hardware that was installed on the International Space Station a year or two ago by the Enterprise, the last mission of that particular space shuttle. They've seen something like 400,000 events so far, and I think they said they've seen something like 400 positrons. Anyhow, of the electron-like particles that they're seeing in the cosmic rays that this detector has found, a high percentage of them have an amount of energy way beyond what we can create with the Large Hadron Collider. In other words, the best particle accelerator on Earth can't come close to the amount of energy of these particles they're seeing. That's item number one. And you get a cosmic ray coming into our solar system, from outside of our solar system, and maybe probably many of the times outside of our galaxy. It's got such a huge amount of energy that it can really penetrate a lot of stuff, but it wouldn't penetrate our whole darn atmosphere without having a collision that would annihilate it. Let me drop. So we're detecting these really powerful particles, and 40% of them that are electron-like have the opposite polarity. They can tell by the way they get deflected in that magnetic field in that detector, because the detector really is a kind of a telescope. It not only detects the particle and measures the amount of energy, it tells you what angle it came from and what polarity it had by the way it gets deflected. So whether or not annihilation is taking place, I mean, most of these things in free space are not undergoing any kind of an annihilation until they get inside of the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And that's where they're being destroyed for the first time, detected, and you're measuring with a kind of a calorimeter, the electronic equivalent of a calorimeter, you're measuring how much energy they've got. They're seeing very large amount of energies, and 40% of them are antimatter positive electrons, which are called positrons. That's as much as I know right now. How they get annihilated, what spectrum they're generating or whatever, don't know. I don't know. And whether or not that has been published information so far. But it tells me, I see the possibility that the missing material that we've been talking about for lots and lots of years, let me drop, where lots of astronomers, lots of cosmologists have said, hey, everything we know about Big Bang tells us there should have been, at the instant of the Big Bang, an equal amount of matter and antimatter. And for the first couple of hundred years of astronomy, we've seen nothing but matter. We've seen essentially no antimatter. Where's all the antimatter? Well, what Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer is telling me, by my interpretation, is that the antimatter is there. And for all we know, half of this universe that we observe is also antimatter. And the cosmic rays that are created in that universe, is my speculation, those cosmic rays, 40% of them we see right now, manage to get into our solar system, get into that detector, and they are positrons.
What is the separation? What justifies the separation?
Separation of what and what? What are you saying? If you're asking me, how does the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer tell the difference between neutron and a positron. They are each a highly fast-moving charged particle, and when they get into that really potent magnetic field off of the alpha magnetic spectrometer, one of them deflects to the right, and one of them deflects to the left, so to speak. The direction of deflection tells you the polarity of that particular particle. The amount of energy tells you how fast it was moving. So they know they're seeing electron-like particles. They know they have the opposite charge. And in my naive way of explaining it, they're calling the positrons. There's nothing else to call them, if you know what I mean. Over to you if you got a question on that, Wes. K2LIW.
It happened that you were touching a very exciting subject today, Dick. My question is, what are the properties of the border between two words? One that is mostly antimatter, and the other one that is one that we know of. I'm not talking about the detector. I'm talking shit.
You and I could now make some great science fiction out of this, Wes. Let's assume that the Andromeda Galaxy just happens to be antimatter, and our Milky Way galaxy just happens to be matter. This is pure speculation on my part. We know that the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way galaxy are going to have a collision. One is going to go through the other. That's going to happen. That's reasonably well known. And I'm not quite sure how long from now, some number of billion years from now, but it's going to happen. And when two galaxies collide, under normal conditions, the spacing between the individual stars is so great that almost none of them hit each other. The two galaxies essentially fall through each other with very few impacts. They disturb the daylight out of each other because of the gravity effects. Each one gets swirled around in a funny way. And so we've seen a whole lot of pictures in the space, like the so-called, I can't think of the name of it now, the Mouse Galaxy Collision. There's a couple of things out there that you can tell two different galaxies folded through each other, and they swirled each other around in funny ways. But it doesn't mean that any of the stars collide each other. Very few of the stars collide. However, if one of those galaxies is matter, and one of them is antimatter, and each galaxy has a hell of a lot of dust in between those stars, and now you got antimatter dust and real matter dust, how does that react? What really happens is an interesting speculation. So there's a hell of a lot more unknown than known here. But we're suddenly seeing, for the first time that I know about, significant evidence of the antimatter that we know must have been there. And all of a sudden, the alpha magnetic spectrometer is saying, here it is. It's staring you in the face. These are really potent particles of cosmic rays.
Repeater, time out.
N2W comment?
Okay, yep. N2 something W, we're going to get to you in a second. So these are really potent cosmic rays coming from outside of our solar system for sure, probably outside of our galaxy, and they are antimatter, so-called positrons. N2 blank W, K2RIW, go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Dick. This is John, N2SLW in Queens. Maybe you've forgotten about the Stardust mission where they went out to capture particles from interstellar dust streams and some comet tail particles. Those are matter. Those interstellar dust streams are matter particles. Otherwise, they would have annihilated the collector. I'm not sure you've got antimatter dust streams traveling through. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, hold on here now, John. You may have read too much into what I'm saying. I am speculating that our whole solar system and probably our whole galaxy and everything in it is 99.99% matter. Somewhere outside of our solar system, probably outside of our galaxy, there is, in my opinion, a significant amount of antimatter. That antimatter that gets here by way of really potent cosmic rays, of the ones that are electron-like cosmic rays, 40% of them are positrons. That's what alpha magnetic spectrometer is starting to see. So somewhere outside of our vicinity, outside of our solar system for sure, probably outside of our galaxy, maybe the adjacent galaxy, maybe the adjacent universe, we don't know. Somewhere outside of our local area, huge energy particles, cosmic ray particles, are antimatter. That's what the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, for the first time, is seeing and say, here it is. That missing antimatter you guys have been looking for, here's the evidence. Now, by way of the AMS, you know the direction of arrival, you know the amount of energy, you know the polarity, you know the difference between matter and antimatter, and it's giving you that evidence. So somewhere out there, and by the way, my understanding is the direction of arrival is almost everywhere. It's not coming from any one particular direction. In other words, somewhere out there in a hell of a lot of directions, let me drop. Somewhere out there in a hell of a lot of directions, there is antimatter. There are exploding stars. There are supernovas and whatever. And in other words, the best speculation I know of is where do these really potent cosmic rays come from? Certain kind of supernova star explosions are doing it. And if those supernova stars just happen to be an antimatter star, and it issues these really potent cosmic rays, and they come into our particular solar system and hit our alpha magnetic spectrometer, and it says, guess what? These guys have got a lot of energy and the wrong polarity. They are positrons. We're starting to see lots of evidence of antimatter for the first time that I think is significant. Does that make a little bit more sense, John? N2SLW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Jake, if you consider the Big Bang as a great producer of heat with no particles and no matter at all because it can't exist at those temperatures, and if the antimatter formed before the matter did, that would put the antimatter at the outskirts of the universe. So maybe some of it's bouncing back. Oh, by the way, if there's 90-something percent of the universe is dark matter, maybe that's dark antimatter we're finding.
Yeah, dark matter and dark antimatter are both going to be very difficult to directly detect. To detect them indirectly, maybe, but to directly detect them, the fact that they're dark, not emitting, it's going to be really hard to detect. So, you're speculating that matter or antimatter has different rates of creation after the Big Bang. I don't know if anybody has ever said that. I think we think that matter is great stuff, and we think antimatter is really strange stuff. The possibility exists that neither one is more strange than the other. That at the instant of Big Bang, you make this gaseous cloud of real hot stuff, which eventually starts cooling off, expanding, and starts giving you individual atoms, molecules, and eventually suns and clouds going around the sun that become planets and galaxies. You start forming all the stuff. And everything I've read leads me to believe that the rate at which you create matter, the rate at which you create antimatter from the Big Bang is probably the same. There's nothing magic about matter versus antimatter. Is one going to be faster than the other? I doubt it. However, everybody up till now has always said everything we know suggests that you must create equal amounts of both in order for the whole darn universe to be balanced. And so of the matter and antimatter that maybe was created in our particular local vicinity, matter dominated and annihilated the antimatter. And the adjacent blob coming out of the Big Bang, antimatter dominated and annihilated most of the matter. So you now have chunks of space out there. We're in one of them, and it's primarily matter. The next chunk of space out there, is it another galaxy or another universe? I don't know. But there's another chunk of space out there that appears to have a hell of a lot of antimatter, and we're now seeing the evidence of it, of those really potent cosmic rays, 40% of them.
Repeater, time out.
Of those really potent cosmic rays, 40% of them, of the electron-like cosmic rays, are antimatter. For all we know, the real ratio is exactly 50-50, and only 40% of them have high enough power to survive the trip and get here and end up in our alpha magnetic spectrometer. For all we know, the whole universe is half and half, matter and antimatter. And how is it distributed? Is the antimatter the local galaxy or the local universe? Someday we're going to find out. Exciting stuff. You think you understand what's going on? You don't understand the problem. Mother Nature did not create this universe for us to be easy to understand. It's one hell of a puzzle. And if you like science, it's great stuff. Anything more you want to add to this, Paul? And I wonder if you've read this one so far. If not, I do recommend you guys go to the NASA site. I'll eventually find a website for you. But you just simply Google the word AMS, Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, and read what the early measurements have discovered so far. And by my standards, if you know what you're reading, I think it's a pretty exciting stuff. WS2N, for anything you want to add to this, Paul? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, I wrote about the discoveries of the antimatter by the Alpha Magnetic Telescope, and a lot more than they figured on. So I remember if it was 40% or not, but whatever it was a lot more. And now they're going to look into that. But, you know, everybody's got their own theories. I think it's being created by black holes. You know, you have matter constantly being created from energy. And when it's near a black hole, sometimes the regular matter gets sucked into the black hole instead of the antimatter, so that leaves the antimatter floating around. I think maybe that's where it's coming from. You know, we have a million black holes all over, everywhere throughout our own galaxy, plus in the center you have a supermassive black hole. It might be doing that. It has something to do with Steve Hawkins' radiation theory. Let me drop it. Back on Voyager 1 and 2. You know, they hear these things out 124 AU. That's where Voyager 1 is. Voyager 2 is a little bit less than that. I think it's 100 or 101. And there's a website you can go to, and it's constantly being updated. I mean, you see the numbers moving. If you go to the regular Voyager website that NASA has, and you were right about the turnaround time for the speed of light for radio transmissions. It was a little over 34 hours for Voyager 1, a little bit less, I think 28 or something for Voyager 2. Now, Voyager 1 is... and two have a little bit, actually a big difference in their trajectory leaving the solar system. Voyager 2 is leaving along the ecliptic, heading out to the Kuiper Belt. You know, that's the one that they had to go past Jupiter, Saturn, and then they said, let's keep going, the Grand Tour, they call it, and it continued on to Uranus, and all the way up to Neptune. Pluto wasn't included because of its location at the time, but that one is still going straight out and going to go to of objects that they've discovered. So we'll be hearing more from that in the future, maybe. It's getting to the end. It's like gone through that whole area already and haven't seen any data on any Kuiper objects. I know the Horizon mission will definitely do that, but they wanted to do that with Voyager 2, but I think they keep shutting equipment down. You gotta remember the RTG, radio isotope thermal electric generator, is losing about a little over four watts per year. So what they do on both these spacecraft, one and two, they keep shutting things down, and they shut down like a dozen or so things over the years, starting around 1990. They're still doing it, and they shut a heater off, and they shut a camera down, and you know, to save wattage, you know, 2 watts here, 2 watts there, so to compensate for the a little over four watt loss per year. So that's what's up with them. They both have big parabolic dish antennas, 3.7 meters, and I remember, I think it was around 11-12 feet diameter, and that's what they're using to communicate with on the S band and the X band. Is what, you know, what they transmit on, receive on. So these two spacecraft probably equal to, like, the weight of two average-sized pianos, around 1,600 pounds each, launched back in 1977. Are still operating 35 years later, over 35 years later. Let me drop it. One was interviewed, and, it, you know, they put it on CBS, radio, CBS radio, and he was there from the launch date, still active, involved with it, and that's just like his baby. So there's an interview. He's usually the go-to guy, and he's the guy that says that these things will eventually be probably shut down or not be able to communicate with after 2025, which isn't bad. I mean, think about it. That's another, what, 12 years or something, so... 2025 is the estimated time when enough power will be lost by the generators, plutonium generators, 238, that they won't any longer be able to communicate with us. They'll keep going. Let me drop it. Some alien group will find this thing many, many eons from now, and on that they have these gold records, CD-type records, but they're bigger than your average CD, more like a 78, an old LP-78. Well, nobody young in 40 will know what that is, but that size. And if an alien group finds it, they'll see what we were like, why we did this. And to think about where they're going to be going, like, for instance, one of them will be going to a star, near a star. I mean, it won't get near, but maybe 2 light-years away, I think 1.7 light-years away. That's about as close it's going to get, and that will take, we talk about time, 35 years, that's nothing. To get near to this first star that it was going to visit, let me drop it. This first star that's going to visit, I have millions of stars over the years, it's going to go around and around the Milky Way for the next, who knows how many millions of years. But just to get to this first star that's going to, if you want to call it, visit 1.7 light years away, will take about 40,000 years. 40,000 years. Well, what, the Egyptian pyramids was, what, 2,000 years ago or something? No, it was 4,000 years ago. Christ walking around on the earth was 2,000 years ago. 40,000 years from now, this thing will be entering or getting somewhat near a star system. That's unbelievable, I think, in my opinion. Still active because it's got a disc on board. You find it, you can play it back and say, hey, I know what the whale sounded like on this earth. Back to you, Dick, WS2X.
Great stuff, Paul. You told me it's going down 4 watts per year out of the nuclear power generator on board. I'd like to know how many watts it started off at. I'm going to pass that back to you in a couple of minutes, but let me show you a couple of other very exciting things about Voyager. You told me it's got a dish 3.7 meters in diameter. That's 12.14 feet, okay? A parabolic dish, 12.14 feet in diameter. Assuming it's got 60% aperture efficiency, a good round number for a good design of a parabolic dish. And because they're operating at 8.5 gigahertz, that's the frequency of Voyager, rounding it off to a little bit, 8.5 gigahertz, 12-foot diameter dish is 48 decibels of gain, 48 dB over isotropic gain. That also means it's got a beam width of 0.668 degrees. 0.68 degrees, let's call it, is the beam width. In other words, in order for Voyager to talk to us, it's got to aim plus or minus the nearest 3/10 of a degree. It's got to aim that dish at the Earth, way out there at 124 astronomical units. So something like 11 billion miles away. Let me drop. billion miles away. It's got this dish with a 6/10 of a degree of beam width. You better aim it to the nearest plus or minus 3/10 of a degree, and even then, you're going to be 3 dB down if you've got that much error. So you better aim it very accurately at the Earth. 48 dB of gain, 10 watts of transmitter power going into it. What does 48 dB of gain and 10 watts mean? An effective radiated power of 650 kilowatts. Let me run that by again. 48 dB of gain means the dish takes whatever power you put into it, and in the main lobe of this flashlight beam, it multiplies the power 65,000 times. If you've got 10 watts of power, it's 650 kilowatts. So, for all practical purposes, if it was an isotropic antenna, if it was an antenna transmitting a signal in all directions at once, let me drop. If you decided you didn't want to carefully aim Voyager, you just want to have an antenna that transmits a signal in all directions at once, so you don't have to worry about aiming it. And in order to do that communication they're doing right now, that would have to be a 650 kilowatt transmitter. No way in hell. However, the magic of microwave parabolic dish antenna, just like the Palomar telescope, which by the way has got 138 dB of gain, that's a real biggie, and a real short wavelength, and it's operating at optical. So this 8.5 gigahertz dish, 12 feet in diameter, with 48 dB of gain, takes the 10 watts you put into it, makes it look like a 650 kilowatt signal. That 650 kilowatt signal goes across 11 billion miles of space. If I go to one of my other programs, I can tell you how many dB of space loss it's got. You then take that tiny little signal into that long distance. I'm amazed it doesn't get tired. You pick it up with a 240-foot diameter dish in Goldstone, California, apply it to a real good low-noise parametric amplifier, and out comes, let me pick a number, 15 dB of signal-to-noise ratio of digital data, saying, NASA, this is what I see out here. So it's decreasing 4 watts per year is what you said, the nuclear power generator. How many watts did it start off with, and how many watts are left, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW in the tech man.
The total watts, I think each one has, I don't know, was 600 or 700 watts. It is 3 generators on board on each one. So it's a gang together. One failed, the other one's okay. You know, it's one of those deals, everything redundancy. The total output was between the three, I think was around 500. I mean, for just the heating purposes, that was what was left over after flying the spacecraft with the necessary electrical power. They would take the heat up the cameras and heat up the electronics and heat up whatever equipment they needed to keep above absolute zero. So, I think it was 2,500 watts or something like that of wasted heat. I mean, they would actually just let the stuff go into space. They didn't need it. It was just too much. So something like that. By the way, I didn't finish. The Voyager 1, Voyager 2 is going on the ecliptic. Voyager 1 is going out like a 45 degree, not quite that much, but almost a 45 degree angle from the ecliptic. And the reason for that is the whole deal was they really wanted to get a good look at Titan when they passed Saturn. They want to look at that because it was cloud covered. Let me drop it. We do that, we take one of the spacecraft, thank God they sent two, and change its course a little bit just to pick up that moon. But by doing it, it had to, they went around kind of like the pole of Titan, and they took pictures behind it, but then that set its trajectory off, and of course they couldn't recover after that. Kind of like a little gravitational assist by that moon, and it sent it off at a almost 45 degree angle. I think it was something like 41 degrees or something, but off the eclipsed plane, which was nice in one respect. Back in the late 80s, let me drop it.